Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around political and cultural issues. I'm Chris Anderson, editor of Wired Magazine, and I'm here with Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, the founders of YouTube. Tonight's speakers are recipients of Inforum's 21st Century Visionary Award, honoring young people who are shaping the future. With YouTube, Hurley and Chen created a new way for millions of people to entertain, educate, rock, and shock one another on a scale we've never seen before. Musicians, amateur filmmakers, comedians, and professional content owners alike are sharing their videos, and some even rise to the top to become stars. Both originally from PayPal, Chad Hurley is responsible for making YouTube one of the most highly trafficked websites in the world, and Steve Chen is the site's key technologist. Please join me in welcoming Chad Hurley and Steve Chen. So with the introductions aside, let me start on a personal note. You two founded were part of a very successful internet company before. You've seen big success. You've seen viral sites take off. But there must have been some moment when you were looking at the server logs of YouTube, when you know, all entrepreneurs think that their idea is the next big thing and it's going to be huge. But there must have been some moment when you realized that it was bigger than you imagined it was going to be. Can you talk about when that was? Was there anything in particular that really sort of said, oh my God, this is going to be awesome?
I don't know. I think we're still in the middle of that. Every day something happens that surprises us. But I think for me, when we hit about 1 million video views a day, I thought that was pretty spectacular. You know, how could it get any better? We're trying to project our growth. We thought, you know, we'll prepare to scale to 30 million views every single day. You know, how can we get there? But you know, now we're serving hundreds of millions of videos every day through our service, and you know, the stories that we hear just about, you know, politicians now using our site, stories of people connecting around the world, really, you know, surprised me, say at least.
Steve, from a technology perspective, you know, there must have been some day when you placed an order for like 100 terabytes or, you know, whatever, when a number you never thought you could leave your lips before. I mean, from a kind of scaling the infrastructure perspective, at what point did you go like way outside any zone you'd been before?
I mean, since the very beginning when we first started the site, we waited for a few months before we reached out for external funding. So much of it was funded by our own credit cards and our own bank accounts. And so we always tried to be pretty sort of frugal when it came to buying servers. And any time that, you know, and I think throughout the last 2 years, really started thinking about sort of what overpurchasing really meant. And, you know, really starting to, with the bandwidth that we're pushing, hearing back from, you know, when we meet with Comcast, that we push something like 6% of Comcast network through the internet is actually coming from YouTube. It's kind of saying that across the world, you know, you have Japan Telecom complaining that we're slowing down the traffic in the Pacific with just the video sites on YouTube. Yeah.
How does that call come in? Hi, it's Japan Telecom. We have a problem.
So, I mean, it's just all across the world. Same thing with South America, and so you know, same thing with the limited people that we have on the team. They're just flying all the time to the different data centers, and they're pretty much living on the plane in the data centers themselves.
Okay. Well, we're going to want to talk about a lot of the business aspects and that, but you know, one of the things that I love most about YouTube is that it's a mirror on ourselves. I mean, you know, traditional television is a mirror on the business model of television. It's constrained by, you know, to mass market one-size-fits-all products by virtue of being a broadcast medium. And the great thing about YouTube is that it's not. It's one-size-fits-one. It is about you, not them. And so in a sense, it's a great lens on our culture, a reflection of who we are that we really haven't been able to see on a massive scale before. And so I guess we see it from the outside. We see YouTube from a user perspective. But from the inside, when you look at the trends and what's surprising, what do you see? What does it say about us?
Yeah, it's surprising to see the trends. I mean, you see different types of content becoming popular within the system. But like I was saying, the stories that we hear of people connecting, I think, really surprises us that YouTube isn't an entertainment destination. It's really becoming a site where people come to be informed and to be inspired through video. And I've talked about this in the past, but I hear stories of actually children in Africa going to computer centers and going there to watch YouTube. And it's, you know, it's inspiring because they're saying that this is acting as a window to the world to them. Mm-hmm. They have a chance to experience cultures beyond their border. They would never have had an opportunity to do that before.
The Coke Mentos video in particular?
Yeah, Coke Mentos, yeah, of course.
that's global culture.
Yeah.
Steve, what is there anything in particular that you've seen on YouTube that you never thought would be popular but was?
Yeah, well, I think some of the stuff that's really compelling to me isn't so much dictated or defined by the number of views they receive, but really just the uniqueness of the content. And it's something that this content you can't find anywhere else, not on TV, not on sort of mobile devices, wherever it's hosted on YouTube. And I think in particular there were these videos that were posted from people from Hurricane Katrina as they were getting out of their cars and then sort of a couple miles behind them taking videos and uploading them to YouTube. And it was really the one place where you can actually see residents mm-hmm. taking videos of these events. And you see this a lot with just a lot of sort of recent events in which you can search for any of these topics on YouTube and find user-generated content that of people that actually live there and are you know, personally impacted by these events rather than from sort of reporters coming in and taking video clips.
Yeah. So it's been 2 years, and presumably the site has evolved from your original vision. Can you talk a little bit about what the differences are between YouTube today and YouTube as you imagined it 2 years ago?
Yeah. You know, initially we thought it would be useful in the auction space because we were coming from PayPal. So we had features initially that people could put these videos. They can still embed videos into auctions with their features, but we were kind of pushing that. We thought it would be a great way for people to describe what they're selling, you know, much better than a photo. But we didn't see people necessarily moving in that direction. We saw people connecting with one another. So we started building more community features. And, you know, along the way, I think that's helped us to be successful is because we'd listen. We would observe. We weren't making any assumptions how people were using the site. We would just adjust and adapt.
So the demand for comments, for example, and the demand for tags and all those things, that's something you learned from the community rather than anticipating.
Yeah, and I mean even search initially, right?
Yeah.
When we first started, we didn't have search.
No.
We didn't know we'd have so much content. People would actually have to search for things. So.
No, I think one of the videos actually that's on the site right now is about, it was a discussion of whether or not to include search in the original release of the site. And it was captured on film asking, should we include search? And Chad mentioned, you know, there are 44 videos on the site. You can put them all on the front page. It doesn't matter.
Glad you got that feature added.
And Google's
real well.
And Google's helping every single day make that better for us.
So, so that's future, past, and present. What about YouTube in 2 years from now? What's that going to look like?
Well, you know, it's hard to say since we're 2 years into mm-hmm. producing YouTube. But you know, we'll work on improving the quality, improving the features for the users, improving ways we're syndicating the video, so ways people can access video. Through mobile devices, ways that people can add content to the system by mm-hmm. having YouTube-enabled devices, you know, direct uploads from video cameras, digital cameras, cell phones, and producing new revenue opportunities for everyone that's participating in that process.
I mean, on the business front, I mean, it's very tempting to look at the existing business model of television. You know, which is fundamentally a one-size-fits-all broadcast model where you show 30-second spots and you interrupt the programming and, you know, I'm going to guess that it's irrelevant to 90% of the audience, but you do it anyway for the sake of reading the 10%. You know, the very sort of annoyance-based advertising model, which has worked very well for television to date, and you contrast it with YouTube, which is all about what you want, when you want it, highly relevant and no interruptions. How do you see television advertising changing as a result of the YouTube effect?
Well, I think we're presenting new opportunities to get in front of an audience that's increasingly spending its time in different places. Mm-hmm. And because our content is about the long tail, people will be able to target against that. And, you know, television advertising, it adds value when you're trying to target against, demographics, location. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to provide that, but we can combine it with what Google's great at, which is relevance.
Do you see this as, I'm asking this question, I know what your answer is going to be, but I have to ask anyway. You know, it seems to be a better model. It seems to be even a model that could compete with television. I presume you also believe it complements traditional television. But now we've seen what Google does to print advertising. We see how important relevance and measurability is in that context. It's very tempting to think the exact same will be true for television, and that when you get the YouTube model exactly right, when you're able to establish relevance and match the right ad with the right content with the right viewer, that the television model will collapse. I mean, we're already seeing declining viewership for television, and the rest of the advertising market is sort of evolving to the Google model. Why shouldn't the same happen for television?
Well, I think they just have more options. I mean, beyond television, people are doing more than just, you know, spending their time online. They're playing games. They're on their cell phones. We're just presenting another opportunity for advertisers, and at the same time, I think we're presenting another opportunity for media companies to work with us and to engage with that audience and really drive them back to the better experience, which is on TV. We feel our product's a great promotional tool. People can engage with content, be interested, and tune into a show. CBS, who has been working with us, adding content on our site, they saw a 5 to 7% rise in the ratings for the shows that they were putting in our system. So in that way, we feel that we're similar.
Is that a perspective that the whole television industry appreciates, the notion that a clip on YouTube is good promotion for the show and will eventually drive audiences back?
Yeah, I think, we're working with over 1,000 media partners that continues to grow every single day, millions of people in the system. And, the majority of the people see the benefit of working with us and get in front of that audience.
So it's the minority that's suing you?
Yes. That is correct. Yes, the minority.
I suppose it only takes one.
Yeah.
let me ask a little bit about about specifically how do you get this advertising model to work? So in traditional television, you know, there's an upfront, and the advertisers know what the product is, they know what the show is, they know what the audience is, and it's pretty clear whether it's a good match or not. With YouTube, it's entirely unpredictable. You just don't know what the content's going to be. How do you make an advertiser, a Procter & Gamble or something like that, comfortable with the sort of messy, unpredictable nature of user-generated content?
Yeah. Well, we have, we had over 1,000 media partners on the site right now. It's a lot of licensed content that they can directly advertise against. We're going to be working with Google. We're doing experiments right now to incorporate advertising and more of the system. We released a user partner program, which is really promoting the people in our system that are creating great content to get to that level. So we have something to share with them, this revenue, to support creativity and have them create even more great content for the system. And I think that'll just continue to grow. I mean, the level of user-generated content in terms of the quality, I think every single day gets better. More and more people have cameras. More and more people have tools to edit. And this is just the tip of the iceberg.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the word quality. And, you know, I think initially a lot of people in TV dismissed user-generated content because it was, quote-unquote, low quality, because it, you know, wasn't well lit, it wasn't well mic'd, and, you know, wasn't well edited, et cetera. And I think that, you know, the success of YouTube suggests there's another dimension of quality, which is relevance. And, you know, sort of it's meaningful to me, and that the production quality is not the only dimension that matters.
Yeah. I mean, people want to watch something that they feel is authentic.
Yeah.
I think, the generation that's growing up right now has been, you know, had advertising forced in front of them. They've been, you know, all about, driving people to go watch the highly produced, very slick programming, and that's not necessarily what people are looking for anymore. They're looking for something that they feel that they can believe in. And I think that not only applies to content that they're viewing, but also advertising.
I mean, I think it's also something that we looked at early on in terms of finding that balance between the quality of the content, the amount of time it takes to start streaming the videos, especially I think with the mass international audience, and making sure that people internationally can access the content in the same sort of quality manner that people in the U.S. can, because while our data centers are mostly distributed where in North America, we had to try to take that balance between the quality of the video itself versus the quality of the content. And I think it was surprising to us, and we toyed around with different figures, but the complaints that we don't receive many complaints about the quality of videos. It's still about just discovery and trying to find finding better ways to find these videos.
Yeah. So it's not that the resolution is just the lack of stuttering and delays and that kind of stuff that matters. If I can ask you to put your sort of cultural anthropologist hat on, it's tempting to look at YouTube as a kind of as part of the overall kind of inversion of power in our culture, where it's kind of less about the top down, the corporate, and more about the grassroots and the authentic and the street and the user generated. I mean, MySpace is clearly part of this. The blogosphere is clearly part of this. The sort of authenticity is, I think, is a word you use that comes from street culture. Do you think that, in fact, the YouTube phenomenon is actually reflecting a generation, a generation's priorities for, the amateur and the real and the stuff that comes from them?
Yeah, I think it's a piece of that. I think we've been successful because early on we made a decision that we wanted everyone to have an opportunity to participate in our platform. We weren't making decisions of who was worth putting on the front page. We allowed the audience to decide what was entertaining or informing to them. And by viewing this content, by rating the content, sharing it with others, they're effectively voting for what was worth watching. So we're going to keep moving in that direction and working with everyone, media companies to users, to have everyone participate and compete on a level playing field.
I think one thing we've also seen is we do some studies about the nature of usage on the site from new users as well as existing users. And instead of seeing people upload videos from the last weekend, new users generally upload content from the last 3, 4, 5 years. That I think this content has been living on people's computers for all that time. They've just never had any access or avenue to explore in terms of sharing this content. So I think this has been sort of a problem that's longstanding, and this is the first easily accessible solution that came out.
Well, on that subject, there were, as you say, there were video sharing sites before. There were ones that charged for the hosting. There were those that that had to review, including Google, that were going to review the video before they would make it public. Yours was free, and there was no filtering review at all. Did you debate that internally, whether it should be free, whether you should charge, whether you should review or not? I mean, how did you decide that now was the right time? I mean, storage costs and bandwidth costs, et cetera, that this was the right model?
I mean, we were just trusting our own instincts of basically what was annoying us online with video. Mm-hmm. I mean, going to video sites and not having a video work for us because you didn't have the right media player on the system. We're working on Macs, and half the time Windows Media wouldn't work for us, and we thought there had to be a better way. So we wanted to create a system where someone could upload any video format and we'd re-encode that into Flash because, majority of the web browsers would play back Flash video.
Yeah.
And, that was kind of the first concept they were looking at. And then also allowing people to search and view this content without having to sign up. And then having the ability to take links or the actual embed code to put this anywhere they wanted to. That really sparked our growth. Is we're treating these embeds as our marketing budget. It was, bandwidth that was existing off of our site, and really we just put a logo on the player, and we'd have functionality that would drive people back to our service, and that pretty much worked for us. It's still kind of the case today. So people experience our site by receiving an email and a link, or coming across a YouTube video and a blog, they come to our site, and we become more and more of a destination as more and more people learn about us.
And that notion of embedded code as marketing was an idea you got from PayPal, right?
Yeah, so we, looking at things of, how we were successful at PayPal, we had payment buttons that we would allow people to take a piece of functionality off of PayPal and put these on websites or, in that case, eBay, to pay for auctions. And we were looking at it in the same way. We're empowering people with a solution that they could take off of our site.
I think you talked a little bit about this sort of the political and social role of YouTube, and it's been fascinating to watch YouTube emerge as a platform for political ads of a very non-traditional sense, and the Hillary 1984 ad is perhaps the most famous of those. But obviously, this is raising a whole new lot. This is a regulated industry. There are rules about political advertising, and I presume they're all sort of open for debate now in the YouTube world. When you look at, as we enter into a presidential campaign, and you look at the increasing role of YouTube as a way to influence voters, what kind of issues come up, and how are you going to deal with them?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is just raise awareness and have more people participate in the process. So right now we have 17 of the presidential candidates on our site. They all have an opportunity to put video content, get their message out there directly to voters. And now voters have an opportunity to directly respond to a candidate. We have users that are submitting questions directly to a candidate, and candidate is actually responding to that. So we're excited about the two-way dialogue that we're bringing to this next election that wasn't available before.
But of course, a lot of the videos are going to be attack ads done sort of, surreptitiously by candidates against other candidates. I imagine this will be controversial. What's your plan on monitoring this?
Now that they have a chance to respond, I mean, I think that's one of the things, that exists on our site. You're open to attacks or, potentially, saying something at an event that you didn't really mean. But, after the fact, you just have a chance to respond to that. You don't have, there isn't the filter of it going through traditional media. And I think the politicians are looking forward to that. We have Tony Blair, who posted two videos on our site congratulating the new Prime Minister of France, both in English and in French. Mm-hmm. So now they have an opportunity to many things. Just any message they want to get out there, whenever they feel like it, they have an opportunity to do that now.
On another theme on sort of democracy and freedom, the military has recently blocked YouTube. I think they claim it's for bandwidth reasons, but you can imagine that Abu Ghraib was an example of what happens when digital imagery from the field gets out there. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, we feel that people need to be informed of what's going on in the world, but we don't want to create a situation where there's security risks for our troops abroad. We hope in time they'll be able to turn us back on. They actually have a channel on YouTube. Trying to recruit people to join the military. So I think they understand it's a good tool. So, it's interesting. I actually had a chance to talk to a soldier that was based in Germany a few weeks ago, and he was disappointed that he didn't have access to YouTube. And because, he was using it as a way to communicate with his family back home, to kind of show them what's going on, and also for him to see videos of his family and his children. And I think, over time, the military will see the benefits that we provide, and we'll work things out.
Let's talk a little bit about how we're redefining television. So the old definition of television was highly produced content in 30-minute increments for mass audiences. And now we have something new. I mean, is this television even? I mean, do we need a new word for the notion of video created that can be consumed, around the world that maybe it has advertising, maybe it doesn't? But I mean, if it's not television, what is it?
Yeah, it's definitely not television. Mm-hmm. It's a different medium. I don't know what you'd want to call it. Maybe come up with some weird term that we can coin tonight. Yeah, it's a different experience. People just have a chance to consume video in 2 to 3 minutes and mm-hmm. very short increments, and that's what we see the majority of the views on our site taking up. People just want to very easily consume this media and move on to something else that interests them. It's very much like a browsing experience when you get online, people jumping around. You can relate what's happening on our site, sort of channel surfing, people not staying on one channel. But mm-hmm. They're small videos, short in length, and they're not the high-quality, long-form content that you see on TV, or much different than that.
Well, if it's not television, does it compete with television? I mean, there are only 24 hours in the day, and we tend to only watch one screen at a time. We've talked a little bit about how video on YouTube can be marketing for television, can promote television, but, fundamentally, you tend to be watching one or the other at any given time. And I'm guessing that if YouTube were Nielsen rated, it would be one of the biggest television networks of all and only getting bigger while the other television networks are getting smaller. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, on some level, do you compete with television?
Well, I think the way that we've looked at it internally was that given the sort of the 24 hours in the day, We're really just talking about video content and the physical medium in which you access this content. So at the end of the day, the content creators, the talent behind creating these videos, they see as platforms, both YouTube, mobile, television, as well as the movie screen, as just ways to showcase their talent. And in a lot of ways, we see really not competing with television as much as just, we're leveraging YouTube and the internet as just another distribution vehicle, same as the television in the living room.
So the old model of television was largely about the distribution, about broadcast, over the air, et cetera. And what you're doing in some sense is extracting content from the method of distributing it. So YouTube is a perfectly good mechanism for distributing television as the content, even though it might compete with television, the broadcast, the delivery mechanism. Is that right?
Yeah. I think what we're providing is just a new way people can spend their time online. Mm-hmm. I think there's just increasingly more and more services online that compete with television. And it's just not online services. It's video games and any other new technology that comes out that people can spend their time doing while they're not watching TV. So I think it's just a world of increased choice.
One of the ironies of television is that there's so much content created, traditional television, so much content created, it's broadcast for a brief moment and then disappears. It's just gone. It's not picked up for syndication. It's not on DVD. If you don't have a DVR, you don't have it. It's just gone. The world's television archives seem like a very rich seam of content out there that could find demand. When you look at that, millions of hours of television stuck in some vault somewhere, does that look like a YouTube opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. What the studios and networks are dealing with is that when they recorded these millions of hours of content, they didn't structure their contracts to deal with the internet or any other types of distribution. So, it's quite complicated for them to unlock all of this. It's a great opportunity for them to once they figure out all their issues, to get the content out there. But I think we're looking forward at the millions of hours of video content ahead of us that everyone's going to be producing. To kind of give you an idea of, in terms of how many hours we're dealing with, every single minute on YouTube, we're receiving nearly 6 hours of video. So there's a lot more to come.
It's going to take me all 24 hours of the day to watch it. Without going too far into the dreaded word copyright, what can you do to help clear those rights? What can you do to help break us out of a model where, as you say, the contracts weren't written with YouTube in mind?
Yeah. Well, I think, getting everyone to think about these issues and the opportunities ahead, because we're trying to figure them out. We're trying to be proactive. We've been the ones in the industry going out and meeting with the media companies to figure out these issues and developing tools that they can work with. We've had a content management tool available, over a year now. So content partners or anyone that's just wanting to find content in their system to take it down, to basically automate the DMCA, they can do so. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is layering on functionality to add more options for them. They can have options to not only remove the content, but actually embrace this content, where they can use it for promotional value or to earn revenue against that.
Can you say a little bit more about how that works? So let's say that I, TiVo, the Colbert Report, and I pick a clip that was interesting to me, and it's of whatever quality I TiVo'd it at, and I tag it in any random way I want to tag it. How does your content management software find that? And how can you make sure that you're catching all of them? Yeah. Not to say you should, but since you are required to do so.
Yeah. Well, we provide the tool to the content partner that it wants to search for this content and remove it from the site.
Let's say I purposely misspell Colbert Report, your content software can't find it.
Yeah. Well, in the future, we're going to be increasing the amount of technology, the layers of technology that we have, audio and video fingerprinting, to make that more effective. And we feel by doing that, we'll be providing a better opportunity for them to find their content. And right now we have a hash that we create for every file that we remove from the site, so it can't get back into the system for the exact file. We've limited, really early on, the length of the videos to 10 minutes in length to cut down on infringement. Mm-hmm. We feel like a lot of opportunities ahead, but we're actively working on solutions.
I think there's one part that I think people Optimus Place, which is the education part. I think, you know, very early on, I mean, just through the processes defined by the DMCA takedown process, that the copyright infringement would be notified to us, and the actual person that uploads the video has an opportunity to be able to say, no, I actually own this piece of content, and counter the DMCA notice. And oftentimes we would get people posting videos, home-created videos, with a piece of audio clip that they've actually legitimately purchased. And they would try to go through this process, and I think it's a matter of education about the fact that even though you did buy this music, you don't have the rights to redistribute this. And so a lot of parts on the site is just making sure that people understand what rights they do have and what rights they don't have when they purchase something legally.
Yeah. And we're trying to create a system that works for everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's... Every single piece of content that's added to our system is copyrighted. When you take a video, it's copyrighted. So for us or for our users to figure out who owns the appropriate rights, you know, take for tonight, for example, if anyone's taking video and they post it, do you have the rights to do so? Is it, you know, this
do they?
Well, no one knows except for the people that officially, you know, would be recording it officially. And you're dealing with venue rights and lots of different issues, so it's hard for an individual to tell that.
So, I mean, taking that example, so someone out here, let's say, has got a camera phone, and they go to YouTube. How will they figure that out? What, you know, how does that educational process work?
Well, they're the rights issues that we're dealing with. We're trying to create a system so everyone has an opportunity to manage their rights and use their content, you know, however they feel appropriate, if that's removing it or keeping it in the system for different opportunities.
So video is different than photographs. So if you take photographs and post them on Flickr and put them out on Creative Commons, I don't have to deal with venue, I don't have to deal with your permission, I don't have to deal with my permission, I just do it. And I presume that's okay, right?
I believe so.
But if it's video, it's not okay?
With video, you're dealing with, you know, people taking video at concerts. You know, that's a performance. Mm-hmm. Then even those performances are tied to venues. The venues have, you know, rights to performances that are taking place there. So there's just lots of different issues that come into the mix, and I you know, by us providing tools that they can use to manage their content, we feel, again, we're providing everyone a level playing field to participate in the process to manage their own content.
And so that's something that you're working on. It's not there yet.
We have content management tools, like I was saying, and out there available, and we're layering on pieces of technology.
Okay. I look forward to trying that. We read a lot about the people who are suing you and the people who don't like the idea of people posting their content, etc. But and you've said that you think that's actually good promotion and that they're wrong in the sense that you know the notion of a 3-minute clip of a TV show is good marketing for that show. Can you give us an example of a major television network or broadcaster who subscribes to your view of that, and what exactly they're doing to take advantage of that?
Yeah, like I mentioned before, CBS. We have other great partner, BBC, mm-hmm. Who's participating in putting content on our site, and they're seeing great results. I mean, they're seeing a lot of people.
So they're putting the content on your site. Mm-hmm. What if I put CBS content on your site? Are they cool with that?
I don't know if they're currently using the tools right now, but we are in the future going to be providing the options for them to deal with that content in different ways. We also have deals with the NHL and NBA, and mm-hmm. we, you know, every day, like I was saying, we're adding more partners to participate in this process. We're a great promotional platform, but I think what we're seeing, we're not a television experience where we're going to drive the concentrated audience. We're a place where people can experience lots of different types of content. And really, at the end of the day, what people want to watch is themselves. People want to watch the content that they're creating. Mm-hmm. It's not about you know, one specific media company that's going to make or break us. It's really the community contributing content, and on a you know every single day, people having cameras and having the opportunity to take their own videos. That's going to become more and more the case.
Mm-hmm. So you were purchased by Google. What was it, about 9 months ago or so? How has that changed your lives, your company, and the vision for YouTube service?
Food, right? They give us great food. That's what I say.
And what? We don't have to manage the searching anymore? They're doing that?
Yeah. They help us improve our search, too. Yeah, no, it's great to work with Google. They have a great culture that's very similar to ours. They have great technology and really smart people that came on board to help us improve our product. That's, you know, at the end of the day, that's why we want to be acquired by Google. We're experiencing phenomenal growth. We're still experiencing that, but we needed more resources so we wouldn't slow down. We were, you know, we could have went through some growing pains, but I think our users would have suffered now by us combining forces with Google. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the direction and the vision for YouTube, how will that change because of the Google?
They're still letting us. I mean, I think the admirable thing is that Eric and Larry and Sergey have had the confidence to still let a pair of 28, 29-year-olds run the company, run the site independent of Google. We're still, from day one, we've kept the company separate from the Mountain View campus for Google. We're still in San Bruno. And they've pretty much asked for what we needed, and they've just granted us all the resources that we needed just to continue the growth of the site.
Now, you weren't sued until you were bought by Google, is that right?
That's right.
So I presume that your legal strategy, which I know was built on sort of an interpretation, I think a good one, but the courts will decide, of the safe harbor provision of the DMCA. But in a sense, you also didn't have deep pockets before, and now you did. Had you assumed that you were going to be sued at some point? And it was
no, never assumed that, you know. No, not at all. You know, we operate under the law. We clearly have done that from day one. We're going to continue to do so. But, yeah, I think, you know, with Google in the picture, people think they have an opportunity to benefit from that. We feel confident in our case, and we're going to keep pursuing with the direction that we're headed.
It's tempting to think of the other companies that had done, you know, really liberated content in early days, Napster, Kazaa, et cetera. They, too, were operating under the advice of lawyers who believed that it was a fair interpretation of the law, and they got sued and didn't survive. They obviously weren't owned by Google, and so they didn't have the same advantages. But, you know, when you look back at the parallels, the legal battles over rights and ownership from the 1990s, what lessons have you learned? You know, what mistakes did they make that you won't make?
Well, just that we're a very different service than those previous ones. And the majority of the people participating in our system are creating their own content. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, we're not about infringing material. Our site's about users that are creating their own material. I think in the past that wasn't the case with music services. But everyone has an opportunity to take video.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think from day one, when we first started the site, we were just sharing videos of what our cats and our dinner party. So, I mean, it was really sort of realizing or knowing the names of everybody that was going to watch the videos, right? It was still just a one-to-few experience. And then what we found out, people embracing the site, is sort of one-to-as-many people as they can experience. And from that, we sort of started seeing the amount of videos that were coming onto the site that had copyrighted audio unwittingly uploaded, and the same thing, copyrighted videos. And really, I think that was when we took embraced the fact that for survival of the company, we had to go beyond just what was required by the law. I mean, really sort of prove the case that a company like YouTube can exist. And so I think across the board, I think there's a bare floor in terms of what we need to do as a site to just qualify for the safe harbors of the DMCA. But I think across all those memes, we've gone way beyond that in terms of the technology that we've built. Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit before about the difference in advertising models, the television one being interrupt, you know, sort of, you know, I'll say this so you don't have to, an annoyance-based model, and YouTube not being. But what have you learned about what people will accept in terms of video advertising online? You know, will they accept interruption? Will they accept pre-roll, post-roll, interstitials, name it?
Yeah, well, I think it's based on all the different things that we're experimenting with. It's the duration of the ad, mm-hmm. It's the relevance of the ad, it's the opportunity for, you know, people to potentially opt into ads and not necessarily be forced to watch an ad. So, you know, with a small test that we've been running on the site, we've, you know, seen great success in some of the concepts that we're working on. And Google is, you know, one of the best companies to work with when you're trying to accomplish that.
Can you talk about some of those concepts?
I mean, some of the concepts that Google already has out is click to play. You know, we'll be introducing that on the site.
What does that mean exactly?
A click-to-play video ad is an ad that basically resides on the page that people click into. But what we're seeing is that, you know, it's not necessarily interrupting the experience when it's relevant, when it means something to you or it's related to that piece of content. So we're going to head in that direction to try to make ads more relevant for people during their viewing experience.
And how about putting advertising into the content itself? I mean, you've largely described ads that run alongside the content.
Yeah.
What about adding pre-roll? I guess we call it bumpers now?
Not bumpers, pre-roll? Yeah, short pre-roll, right, bumpers. yeah, I mean, we're looking at how effective they would work for our site, but for the most part, what we're concentrating on is the best user experience. We don't want to introduce anything that's going to reduce our views. We want to keep increasing the traffic. By doing that, you do that by not introducing ads that are annoying or get in your way of watching more.
In your exploration of the definition of annoying, can you talk about anything that you tried that didn't work? Anytime you say we tried something and the audience very, very, very explicitly said no.
I'm trying to think offhand. No, I can't think of anything specifically. I think what it came down to were just testing different lengths of video.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the longer the video runs, the less interested someone becomes. So
there's definitely a length of videos in the pre-rolls in which 80% of the people drop off watching the video. So.
What length is that?
I mean, when you're approaching, the new 15-second mark, it seems a little bit too long, even though it's shorter than the 30-second.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we tolerate 30 seconds on TV, but we won't tolerate more than 15 seconds online.
Yeah, and that's pretty long when you're talking online experience, too.
Wow. So in about a few minutes, we're going to start taking audience questions. So if you have a question, line up behind this microphone here, and very shortly, we'll get to you. Shorter? So as we look at YouTube as a lens on our culture, we're looking for shorter. So 30 minutes became 3 minutes. 30 seconds became less than 15 seconds. It's all much, much quicker. The advertising world doesn't change as quickly as the internet world does. Are you seeing a kind of a reinvention of what video advertising can be as people try to sort of, make 5 seconds, meaningful? Can you tell a story in 5 seconds? Can you do narrative forms still work?
Yeah, I mean, the agencies need to become creative. We're working with them to try to create new concepts. I think the opportunities by creating a shorter ad, more people can participate in the process. So, capturing the more of the long tail of the advertisers out there, advertisers that want to produce their own commercial, essentially, local advertisers now have an opportunity to do that cost effectively. So.
You very kindly mentioned the long tail, but there's another phrase, which is the torso.
Yes.
Tell me what torso means to you as content providers and advertisers.
Yeah, well, we see great opportunities to work not only with the major media companies to provide a new way to get in front of an audience and a great promotional platform, but there's a lot of people in between the users producing everyday clips. There's independent filmmakers. There's hundreds of cable shows and networks around the world that don't have an opportunity to be one of those major networks or studios, but are looking for that audience. And now they have a chance to participate, too. So we're really excited about that. For creative individuals to have a direct line to getting in front of someone without having to rely on distribution that's controlled by someone in Hollywood.
So in a sense, we think of the television industry being the interest of the major networks, and they're often threatened by YouTube, but there's a whole other tier of smaller players who don't get enough distribution, who don't feel that they're getting the audiences they could. And your sense is that YouTube is seen more generally as a positive for that audience?
Yeah, definitely. And they have a chance not only to get in front of a new audience, but to be discovered. They can take it to the next level. We have many users on our site that have signed record deals or deals with TV networks to produce shows. And now we're just providing a new opportunity for them to be discovered.
The new American Idol. Before we take the audience questions, I want to end on one last sort of anecdotal note. Steve, I'll put you on the hot spot. The infrastructure scaling that you've been through is pretty much unprecedented in history. Was there ever a moment where you just sort of, it just melted down and you said, oh my God, we can't keep up, it's, you got the call at 3 o'clock in the morning and you realize that you may have just broken, your code.
No, I think it's, a lot of the same people on the YouTube team, the engineer and architecture team, we've known each other for 5-6 years, all through pretty much the best talent of PayPal. they're wearing YouTube badges now. And with a lot of these guys, we've gone through just a lot of lessons learned. And it's definitely a lot easier the second time around in terms of not making the same mistakes that we made at PayPal. So, hate to sound arrogant, but, it was incredibly... surprising for us at the pace that we had to scale up, building something that didn't exist 12 months ago in terms of our own data centers, our own bandwidth, and our own network, to something that right now is the sort of the largest private network on the internet within this 12-month cycle. It's shocking, but at the same time, knowing the same people that have done this one time at PayPal and bringing them into YouTube has made it a lot easier.
That makes sense. So for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inform program. And tonight we're talking to YouTube founders Chad Hurley and Steve Chen. I'm Chris Anderson, editor of Wired Magazine. Now let's go to the audience for questions. If you could keep the questions short and actual questions, please.
We've been through a decade where the internet has largely been exempt from a lot of regulations on old media because it's experimental and an infant industry. Now, though, the old media are on the ropes. Google's a giant. To the extent that TV, for instance, is subject to indecency regulation or any other kind of regulation, why shouldn't that apply to you now?
Well, regulations on TV are imposed because of they're regulating the airwaves. There's a limited spectrum. On the internet, there's infinite choice, infinite spectrum. So it doesn't necessarily apply. When we're talking about regulations about what's appropriate, we've made it very clear to our community by providing community guidelines and having terms of use that prohibit anything that's infringing, anything that's pornographic, anything that's hateful, violent from our site. And our community understands that, and now they're very proactive in protecting what they've created by us providing tools to them so they can easily flag content and it comes down within minutes.
Hey guys. So YouTube is obviously a phenomenal tool for access to information. I wanted to sort of broach with you what the impact to a targeted advertising model might do in terms of, if there's targeted advertising, there's obviously going to be much more interest in keeping track of who people are and what they're looking at online, and sort of what the impact on privacy and free speech and what safeguards you guys are going to put in place if you do move to a targeted advertising model.
Yeah. I mean, right now we're going to take all that into account. We definitely want to make the ads relevant, but protect the user's privacy. Right now we're going to be looking at the relevance of the information surrounding the video, so tags and descriptions. Over time we'll look at making improvements, but we'll always have the users in mind.
I was fortunate enough to see the congressional testimony, and although I kind of really want to hear if it was intimidating being in front of Congress, I truly want to hear you talk about when Mark Cuban said that you and Google were hiding behind the DMCA. How'd that make you feel, and how do you respond to that?
Mark, yeah. what can I say? I don't know. He always likes to make big comments to, have his name printed in newspapers, but
he was the one that said what? Only a moron would buy YouTube the week before Google acquired it.
Yeah, so I don't know. It was a great experience to be there, it was a smaller room than I anticipated. I thought it would be this huge room with a lot of people behind us, but it wasn't that big, and I thought more people would be on the panel in front of us asking questions, but. No, it was great just to be there and have an opportunity to tell them what we're up to. Mark is trying to push HD programming. He has a different agenda to try to tell the world why we've been successful. When we're pushing low quality videos, it's not the direction that he wants the video world to head. So, we feel confident in what we're doing, and we're going to keep concentrating on improving that experience for our users. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Peter Gisella. There's this phrase, a picture's worth 1,000 words, and YouTube provides good entertainment and some fad movements, but I would like to question you along the lines of education. Could you comment on your experiences when you were in college and the educational training you went through, and if you were to be exposed to U2 now as another distraction among the other things you experienced, how would that take away from your rigorous educational training that allowed you to create U2 and get a job at PayPal? It seems to me that there are a lot of distractions, and rigorous education is a challenge.
Yeah. I don't know. Steve, do you want to take this one?
Well, I'd probably like to answer it from the other perspective, which is trying to embrace YouTube as just actually a platform to get content out there, again, from the educational side. I think one area that I'm an amateur chef, and to actually go onto Google to search for, you know, how to julienne an onion, and actually getting a link back to YouTube as the first link, and actually seeing that in person is something that I find pretty fascinating. I think also from just people that have some message out there, something that they want to teach other people, to really embrace YouTube as a platform to be able to do that.
Yeah. That's good. That was a good answer.
Hi, I'm Guillaume Cohen from Veolia. Well, first, congratulations.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. First, what percentage of the content you think can be monetized through advertising, and is that sufficient to sustain usage for all the other content that advertisers may not want to put their brand may not want to associate their brand with? And second question is, what do you think about the new wave of live video broadcasting? That's what my company is doing right now. I was curious to have your take on the new wave for live video.
Oh, for live. First of all, I think the video content on our site, we wouldn't put advertising against that video until someone opted into a program that we're providing them. So, you know, as we expand a user partner program, you know, we won't put ads against that content, so you actually want us to.
Also on the, I think most important is just that user experience at the end of the day, right? I mean, I think we've always had the option of putting video advertising, whatever it is, and we knew very well that it paid much better than text advertising, but at the same time, knowing that we ourselves didn't want to see that advertising, we didn't want to force it upon our users. But through some of the tests that we've done, one program that we have on the site, which is this participatory video ad on the front page, which is something, I mean, every time you go to YouTube, that video on the front page is a paid advertising, and you have to click to play it. And we found surprising to us that a lot of people were actively clicking on that and actively watching that video through completion and going on and interacting with that video. And I think that sort of speaks well to the fact that if the content is good, if the content is relevant, that people won't think of it as advertising. They'll just think of it as entertainment.
Yeah. And then live video. I don't know. I think there's market opportunity there. I don't think we're going to head in that direction. We're more about clips and giving people access to particular clips anytime that they want. One of the things with live video, I don't know how easy it would be to aggregate an audience when something interesting is happening to a particular person if you have a lot of people participating in that process. But I don't know. Maybe there's ways to get people to view something when it's actively happening.
I'm going to cheat with a two-part question, but the second part is really quick. And the first is, you talked a lot about dealing with copyright infringement from shows and NBC, and you dealt with solutions to that seem to make sense for a large network that has time to track this. But I was checking in the Diet Coke and Mentos video that was on Rever, and the Noah Kalina, a photo of myself every day video that was first on Vimeo, got the vast majority of their views on YouTube. And how do you deal with those content providers who might feel that they're small, that they can't fight YouTube as maybe NBC can work out a deal? These people who feel like they're kind of getting stepped on and being forced that they're going to be on the site either way, whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
And the second part is I watched some good BBC stuff on there, and I was wondering how you guys deal with them because they're really into open, open sourcing their video.
Yeah. So the first part, I mean, we'll be providing the tools for everyone to manage content within the system. So if it's something that gets up there, we're not just going to make these tools available just to media partners. It'll be available to everyone. And then second of all, you have the same options to take advantage of our audience. We didn't want to build an audience or build a site around rewarding people with money. We wanted to build a true community. I think we've actually done that, and now we have an opportunity to share revenue with users without changing the core of what YouTube's about. And the second part about the BBC, I mean, yeah, we're really happy to be working with them. And actually, I was just in London earlier this week, and you know, they're happy with the results. They're creating a new audience and driving people to view content around the world that they never had access to get in front of before. So they're excited about that.
Dean Takahashi at the San Jose Mercury News. And two questions. What are you spending all of your money on? and the other is, what's your all-time favorite videos on YouTube?
What are you spending your money on, Steve? I'll let Steve take this one again.
What I think the we frequently get asked this question. I think still to this day, you'll find us online. You know, we still probably call each other at 11 p.m. just to go over the same thing. I mean, it's been a habit since the very beginning, and still is doing the sort of 80, 90-hour weeks. And even after the acquisition, I think in terms of work habit, not just for us, but everyone at the company, it's remained relatively the same. So in some senses, I mean, other than, you know, buying a faster car to get to work faster and return to work faster, there hasn't been much change.
Favorite video?
What's that?
Your favorite videos on YouTube?
Favorite videos. Oh, there's so many. I mean, I think what I really enjoy seeing is just the chance to experience other places in the world. I mean, just, you know, staying in the office, just seeing what the traffic looks like, you know, on an Indian street. You know, what people are doing in Tokyo. I just, to me, that's just exciting to see that, and I think you know, a lot of other people enjoy that too.
Hi, my name is Prashant. With already millions of hours of videos existing and more coming up, how do you think users are going to find like videos that are relevant to them, and how they're going to navigate, you think?
Yeah, we're always working on that. You want to talk about the technology piece? I mean, beyond search, I think there's other ways that we can have people kind of browse through a directory-type structure. We have to figure out how we're going to put that together. But I think, yeah, we have so much content in the system, it's hard for everything to get exposure. And we're always looking at new options to make, you know, raise relevance to present a piece of content to someone that they would, like, actually enjoy watching. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's a really different experience from, say, search in terms of Google. And, you know, when you're searching for something on Google, what you want is the most relevant results most of the time. Whereas on YouTube, I think it varies a lot depending on when was the last time you conducted the search, if this is something that you've been to the site in the last 4 hours to keep searching for the same content. And so I think while we want to make search for enable search as the way to pinpoint the piece of content that you want to watch, I think we also want to bubble up a lot of the community feedback and the community behavior to say that, you know, people that have watched this video are also watching these videos. People that have contributed these videos like these videos.
Thank you.
Steve Chen here, no relation. And, and it's a two-part question, actually. One is, you guys are essentially the rock stars of the tech industry now. And so can you even go outside without getting mobbed by, like, other people? And number two part is, when you do have time to go out, is there any, like, social or philanthropic organizations that you guys are championing or pushing out there as well?
Yeah. No, you know, unfortunately, yeah, we're not noticed that much. I mean, every once in a while, when I'm on an airplane or in the airport, someone might notice me. But for the most part, no. We're not at the level of, like, Angelina or something. It's not that bad. You know, it's good. I wouldn't be able to stand that. And then, yeah, on the charity side, I think there's a lot of great opportunities. I've had a chance to go, you know, speak to kids at my old high school, college. Had a chance to go speak to Dean Kamen's event, FIRST, which promotes robotics and learning. And it's great just to go back and talk to kids and actually tell them that they have a chance to do the same thing, because I feel that, you know, I'm coming from the same background where, you know, I didn't necessarily know, you know, something like this was possible, but I just want to let them know that they have a chance to do the same.
And then, I mean, I think on the site itself, too, just because of all the inventory, the mass inventory that we have on the site in terms of advertising, but still trying to figure out what the best advertising models are, we've given up a lot of this inventory to just a lot of different organizations that have reached out to us in terms of trying to get relevant banner ads and different things on the site, and we've been very open about trying to open that up to other organizations.
There's a lot of nonprofits working with us to put their content on YouTube. You know, it's a new channel for them to get their message out there, get more people involved. So we're excited about that.
Thank you.
Good evening, guys. I just have a quick question about the relevancy of comments on YouTube and where you kind of see that's going. The way that Wikipedia has been able to get people to describe a topic or provide commentary. Are you introducing tools that'll help people describe content uploaded to YouTube?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at all the options, how we can embrace the active community that we have on the site. I mean, I think that can definitely improve the relevance and engage with the content in a more active way beyond just viewing and rating the content. So we're looking at ways to get them more involved. I don't know about that specific idea, if we have that in the works on the tech side.
Well, I know
side.
That. I mean, in the last couple of months, we launched, we changed when if you're on the video page watching a video on YouTube, on the right side there's a section for related videos. And we've changed the algorithm in which those videos are computed based on, previously we had it based on conducting a search on the background, on the current video, the keywords of the current video, the title, description, and trying to find things that are closest to, in terms of the search results, closest to the video that you're currently watching. And the drawback for that is that if you're watching a video about cars, you're probably going to only receive recommendations about cars, but there may be more relevant videos on the site that don't correlate in terms of title, words, descriptions, but just in the general taste of the videos themselves. And what we've done recently was changed to really just matching user behavior patterns. So if you watch the same 8 videos as these 10 other people, you'll probably be interested in the 9th video that these 10 other people have watched. And we've seen that it jumps around a lot. You'll sometimes kind of wonder why these things are recommended, but you'll see after you click on the video to play it that it's something that you'll probably enjoy.
Thanks.
Speaking of Mark Cuban, perhaps he's not the best example to use with YouTube, but people look back and there's much has been written about him making a very wise investment decision when he sold Broadcast.com and hedging the stock of the acquiring company. And I wonder if the two of you or one of you has taken similar steps, and maybe there were some restrictions in the contract with Google that prevented you from doing such, but I'm just curious about that.
No, we haven't done that. No.
I'll give you my business card up.
Hi. I just have, I guess my question is concerned security. If you've confronted any security, either risks or issues when thinking about how you manage your system, your infrastructure, or even as a content providing part of the internet, if you've thought about security, how you've thought about security, and the ways that you've kind of confronted that,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, you know, coming from PayPal, I guess we have a good background in worrying about security and fraud in terms of the architecture.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, again, based on the same sort of staff that built up a financial system and ensuring that it had to meet all the security standards for a financial system, sort of took those same lessons, probably to a degree far more necessary for a sort of video distribution site, but it built up the same data work, the data warehouses and the same networks in the same secure fashion that we built out the financial institutions.
We've probably only got room for maybe another 2 or 3 questions, so let's make them quick.
This is for you, Chad. I'm from Reading, Pennsylvania, like you.
Yeah.
And I want to congratulate you for breaking free. I want to ask you what it was like to go from a place like Reading to, say, Switzerland this past year, to go to Davos to meet with world leaders at the Economic Forum. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, a little bit different than Reading. You know, not as many pretzels or cheesesteaks or hoagies out there. No, but yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a neat experience to have an opportunity to go to Davos. You know, and it's kind of inspiring when you get to meet people that are working on a lot of great causes. You know, trying to address global issues, and I think we have an opportunity to work with them to you know, help further their message, or to get in front of people on YouTube to help accomplish that. But yeah, it's much different than sitting in Reading, Pennsylvania to go to Davos.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know about trends that relate to personal content, so my picture of my friends and my or my video of my friends and I on a certain excursion versus commercial content, and whether or not you're seeing much trend up in terms of percentage of the content being uploaded, more commercial content being uploaded, and also more commercial-related searches being performed on the site.
I mean, we see the majority of the people enjoying what they're making on the site, making themselves, and you know, they're actively looking for people to connect with in our service. People subscribing to each other and sending messages to each other because they enjoy what they're producing. And I think that's a trend that we'll continue to see moving forward. And you know, on the professional side, I see more of them actually participating in that process where they engage with the audience beyond just putting content up in our system. You know, looking at how people are viewing their content and adjusting their programming to be more relevant to the people that are actually watching it.
No, I mean, I think defining sort of content just based on entertainment value, you know, regardless of the production value that went into producing that content, I think one interesting metric of that is just going to the browse page on the site, I mean, on the top of the site of about, you know, the videos that have received the most views, the most commented videos, and you'll see just sporadically sprinkled in there, there's going to be content that's by a professionally produced content, but then at the same time, sitting right next to it, there's going to be user-generated content, and it just repeats itself on a daily basis, which just means that, you know, people are just interested in entertainment.
Thank you.
And this will be the last question.
Regarding user-generated content and how you've kind of revolutionized the internet, what would you say was the single most or top two or three relevant decisions that really shot YouTube beyond its competitors?
You know, the first, I think, was the encoding, allowing anyone to put any type of video file in the system and having it, you know, playback and flash on our site was definitely a big one. And then allowing people to take these videos, you know, if they added them themselves or they just came across the video to put these videos anywhere that they wanted, I think set us apart. There were, you know, at the time, I don't think there was any other services really doing something the same way.
I mean, I think we definitely led the pack there in terms of being able to use the Flash video players because, I mean, I think all the time, again, back to the some of the decisions why we made the decisions the way we did was, you know, a lot of sites out there, even to this day, they would ask you about whether or not you had whatever Windows Media Player, QuickTime, or a Real Player installed on your computer, and then it would ask you about sort of the bit rate of your internet connection. It just seems like it's just a very awkward experience, especially for people that aren't working with computers all the time when they really want to just watch a video. And so I think definitely we led a few months in using Flash and transcoding all the different types of codecs out there that are produced by cameras, produced by webcams, to this one universal format that all the computers already had.
That's all we have time for tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club's In Forum is adjourned, and please join me in giving a big hand to YouTube founders Chad Hurley and Steve Chen.